I don't have anything against it, no.
There's no.
I'm okay.
Hey, Water Environment Committee, we'll come to order. Welcome this morning. Good to see you here. We're looking forward to some interesting presentations this morning. First, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2790 and have the staff read this summary.
House Bill 2790 was the bill we looked at on Monday that specified the contents of a nominating petition for the election of a member to an irrigation district board. And it just established some of the criteria that needs to be on that nominating petition, and it has requirements for how openings for the board of directors should be posted in a newspaper or in public places. Okay, committee, you might remember we had a letter from the Oregon Water Resources Congress on this issue. I don't believe there's opposition to it, but we had not scheduled a work session that day, so that is the purpose of this work session.
Madam Chair, I would like to make a motion that we move House Bill 2790 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Morgan has moved House Bill 2790 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Representative Hass.
My only concern here was that it's not uncommon for people to lease farms or to lease these homes. And under these laws, those people, even if they have a stake in this, would not be allowed to, from what I can tell, would not be allowed to be candidates.
Ms. McNitt, would you, can you respond to that?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Hass. That's true, except that those residents may not necessarily be electors within an irrigation district, which means that they wouldn't be members, they wouldn't be receiving the services, and correspondingly, they wouldn't be paying any assessments either. So they really wouldn't have any interest in voting in an irrigation district election. I don't know if I should do this or not and complicate things, but we actually had a request for some amendments that haven't been printed yet. But if the committee chooses to move it to the floor, it's not that big of a deal. When I had testified previously, I indicated that irrigation districts are divided by divisions, like legislative districts are divided by precincts. Irrigation districts are divided by divisions. And the language in the bill mixed division and district. And so we had an amendment. It was supposed to be ready today. I don't see it. It's not that big of a deal if you don't consider it that big of a deal, and we could fix it on the Senate side.
Christina, can you tell me now where it says electors? You're not making that change in your bill, are you? That's already in existing statute, the term electors.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Thank you. Further discussion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Representative
Johnson?
Aye.
Representative King?
Aye.
Representative Lee?
Aye.
Representative Lee? Excuse. Representative Lee?
Aye.
Representative Morgan?
Aye.
Both sides. Motion is passed. And House Bill 2790 will go to the floor. We need a carrier. Representative.
How about
Cruz?
Representative Lee?
Huh?
How about Representative Lee, since it's her bill?
Yes.
Excuse me. It is her bill. Representative Lee will carry this bill. Thank you very much.
She can't get out of the change.
I wasn't expecting that.
Okay, we'll close the session on House Bill 2790. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2753 appropriates money from the general fund to the Department of Administrative Services for the Oregon Graduate Institute of Science and Technology for their
Torrey River Spray Modeling Program. This bill declares emergency effective July 1st, 2001. You also have a fiscal statement attached to your packet, and this does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Okay, I'd like to call for Ken Strobeck, former state representative, with a new hat on. We're all together. Would you all like to come up together?
It'll be fine. I'll just come up, and then they'll be available for questions.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ken Strobeck, and I'm here representing OGI, the Oregon Graduate Institute of Science and Technology. I want to thank the chair for scheduling the hearing today on this bill, House Bill 2753, and I think you'll see a fascinating presentation about the technology that's been developed at OGI right here in Oregon. OGI is located in Hillsboro and is in the process of going through a merger with OHSU. That bill, Senate Bill 511, passed out of Senate Education, is on the way to the House floor. So this is the beginning of another exciting development in the technology and the merger of the sciences of, that have to do with both health and environmental science. What we want to do today is to show you the CORI project as it exists in the lower Columbia River, and what this bill calls for is the addition of that technology to the lower Willamette River. There's so much focus and attention on the Willamette River in terms of the salmon restoration, Superfund cleanup, and uses of the river, and a lot of the decisions that are made are based on either opinions or sort of competing ideas rather than on actual science and observed data. And what this bill, or what this technology allows you to do is to see exactly what's going on in the river. And we hope that the committee will go into work session today and pass this on to Ways and Means. I've spoken with a number of folks in other agencies and other parts of the state that are interested in the cleanup of the river and watching the river, and we expect that once they see what the capabilities are with this basically homegrown technology, that they'll be interested in using it for the Willamette to get some real good science out of that. Joining me today is our two distinguished professors from OGI. Dr. Antonio Baptista will be doing the presentation, and then Phil Barrett, who's also here, will be available to answer any questions that you might have. So with your permission, Chair, I would just ask Antonio to get started with the presentation.
Chair Close, members of the committee, with the permission, I'll speak from here, and I will have a visual presentation.
Thank you. Thank you for coming.
Thank you. Of course, technology, as we know, always have its quirks, and one of the quirks is that things are never ready when they are supposed to. Get through that. So what I would like to do first is to start by explaining what CORI is, and it will take just a second for the brightness of the projector to show up. So I'd like to start by telling you what CORI is. And CORI is an environmental information infrastructure. The concept is that environmental information with quantification of its reliability can and should be delivered to the right user at the right time in right format for the specific needs. CORI is a pilot environmental information structure. We have been developing it since 1996, and we have developed it for the lower Columbia River. The easiest analogy of this system is weather forecasting. You no longer question the fact that at 6 p.m. you can tune in and listen to the weather forecast in the news. What we are trying to do is very similar, except it's for the river. How does the system work? Very much like a weather forecasting system. What we have here is the need to collect data, quite a bit of data in fairly sophisticated ways and in real time. We have a number of computer models that complement what we are collecting in terms of data. Once we use those types of tools to understand the system, how it behaves, its dynamics, we create a number of products that then are used generically, and also customized to a number of applications, including from fisheries, irrigation, water quality, and so forth. It is important to point out that CORE is a multi-purpose, multi-user infrastructure. It's not developed for a particular purpose or for a particular use. We are trying to avoid the notion of reinventing the wheel. We are trying to be able to provide answers quickly without having to start studies from scratch every time any question is asked. For instance, when DEQ a couple of months ago called and asked, do you know much about salinity via the city of Astoria, effluent, we could give an answer right away. We didn't need to put sensors in the water or do special studies. The data was available. And this happens time and again with applications in the system. So what can CORE do? One of the things that CORE can do is to deliver sensor data at your desk through an internet browser. Sometime last afternoon, I needed to look at the characteristics of one of the sensors. It took me a few seconds to generate this diagram that shows water levels at the particular station that I was looking at, salinity and temperature. You can do that from your computer at home, from your computer in your office. Everybody can. It's publicly available. The other thing that CORE can do, besides delivering sensor information to you conveniently, is to create forecasts, much in the way of a weather forecast. For instance, before I left my office last evening, I just looked at most recent forecasts for the currents in the Columbia River. The yellows represent high velocities, the blues represent low velocities, and that was the picture as predicted for the Columbia River at 7:30. We can also take this information and look retrospectively at what happens over time. For instance, what you are looking at here is a compilation of the information that CORE has accumulated, in this case, for the month of June, and we are looking at the salinity, of the variation of salinity in the estuary as the tide comes in and out across several days. As you remember, salinity, for instance, is a major issue in channel deepening and potential impacts of channel deepening. This type of tool enables you to understand behaviors of parameters like CORE in a fairly effective manner. As we generate information from models and from sensors, that information becomes difficult to interpret. And one of the challenges that that CORE has addressed well is to look at the user, try to understand what the user needs, and compile information that has been collected into something that is useful to the user. For instance, in working with National Marine Fisheries Service, as an example, we have developed a methodology to try to compare physical habitats favorable to juvenile salmon. In modern systems, for instance, with red symbols here, and in pre-development systems, the details here are not particularly important. What is important is the fact that we were able to provide information to the user that is targeted to the user, even if it comes from a multitude of data that is very difficult to interpret as it was. This approach is attractive enough that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife will likely start to collaborate next month with us in extending these to other species. So I told you what CORE can do now. What we are proposing is certainly to extend the capabilities of CORE. Expand them in terms of the physical area of application. We'll have a lot more physical presence in the Willamette River. In terms of the types of parameters that we measure, in terms of the ability to actively be involved in water quality issues, and also in particular in terms of the ability to take the information that we already have and that we'll be generating and make that systematically available to a number of state agencies. Reasons to do that are significant. They tie in with sustainable development. Sustainable development is starting to ask complex questions. And sustainable development in the lower Columbia and the Willamette River region is going to have to operate under a number of restrictions. And those imply, in particular, clear attention to at least three major federal environmental laws related to listing of salmon and steelhead under the Endangered Species Act, designation of Portland Harbor as a Superfund site, adoption of water quality protection guidelines and the Clean Water Act. Now, we can't really navigate these sustainable development issues without regional cooperation. And regional cooperation needs support, which is technical, scientifically involved. So one of the things that is a really major benefit of these types of approach, environmental information systems, is that they are really the logical base for regional cooperation. One of the key things that we have found in our experience is that objective information will foster consensus on what should be non-controversial issues. In many cases, sustainable development issues are not thwarted at the level of what should be controversial. They are thwarted below that, at the level of things that we know or should know, and we can't agree upon. By having a regional infrastructure like CORI in place, in which stakeholders have participation from scratch in terms of helping design, helping use, and certainly reacting the products. We feel that we can especially reduce divided conflicts, avoid costly delays. I can easily point to a number of examples of things that are happening now that present the opposite approach to CORI is an alternative to those. And also an important point in our experience is that CORI, through the involvement of Oregon agencies, we could help balance the representation of state and federal agencies on some of these issues. And as you highlight, for instance, in the Superfund site declaration for the Portland Harbor and so forth, that's a significant issue and an important one to address in a systematic basis, in a non-conflicting basis. That's all what I have. I'll be glad to answer any questions that you might have or clarify any aspects if I haven't been clear enough. Thank you.
I guess I have a question. We're told a lot to be careful of quote-unquote junk science and to try to get hard science. Would you, and this appears to be hard science, can you comment on that for me?
Yes. I am what you would call a hard scientist. My basic funding comes from agencies like the National Science Foundation, Office of Naval Research, and so forth. I'm used to the competitive aspects of science, the peer-reviewed aspects. I have a significant publication list. CORI was developed as both a scientific and management infrastructure. We use CORI for our research. A lot of our research projects are based on CORI. And we have to have the same standards that we have for any other science when we develop CORI. We also are extremely careful at trying to quantify errors and uncertainty, and we consider that extremely important. I'll give you a simple example in response to your question. For instance, every day we produce a daily forecast for the conditions of the given. This is the daily forecast that I that was in the web at 10:45 last night. What you see here, on top, you see two curves. You can barely distinguish them, but there is a black curve underneath, which is our forecast, and there is a red curve on top that for this station represents the sensor information that we are doing. We are doing a forecasting and we are comparing with real data that is coming in. We are not doing forecasts for salinity or temperature in this particular application, but we are doing forecasts of velocity, and you can see the errors that we are observing. So we have mechanisms to quantify errors and uncertainties, and we consider that a significant part of the benefits of this. Because you cannot argue, once you have these types of comparisons, you cannot argue in terms of what you have. You can argue in terms of what it may mean. But you have a solid basis from which to start your discussion. And that's one of the key points.
Representative Morgan.
The map that is on the top of that display there, is that the geographic scope that the project covers?
Chair Close, Representative Morgan, no, it's not. This is one of the many displays that we have. I will try to explain the geographic scope. This is the backyard that we look at. We don't do things in this entire backyard. This is a map of the Columbia River, of course, Columbia River Basin, including the land and the pond, the ocean side of it. from a modeling viewpoint, our system starts here at Bonneville Dam and goes out to the ocean, including an element of the Willamette River and the Cowlitz River, not representing it. In terms of the physical presence of our sensors, it's mostly in the estuary side, a little bit in the ocean side, and we rely on information that exists from other agencies in other areas. One of the things that we are proposing is to have a concentration of physical presence in the Willamette area as well. But we currently are doing modeling for that area, and following up on the previous question, the advantage of having a physical presence and the ability to have sensors that calibrate the forecast is that you can quantify your uncertainty in that area. Right now, we are much more solid in how we quantify uncertainty here than we are now quantified there. And it's quite important to have that increased ability to quantify uncertainty when you start using this information for decision making in these regions. We feel comfortable in many of the things that we have been doing in support of these regions, that we need to have that same level of confidence as we come to the world.
May I have a follow-up, Representative Morgan? What's the technology that's involved in gathering the data? Are you building on existing technology, or are you actually putting in your own stations?
Share close, Representative Morgan, both. When we developed CORI, we looked at what was available in Columbia River Basin in terms of sensors, and we looked at gaps. And one of and we also looked at what we could use already. We used that, stations from USGS, Port of Portland, Port of Engineers, and so forth. We used everything that we can use that is already in place. But when we started development of station network, we looked at the estuary, and the estuary was very, very poor in terms of what was being measured. So we concentrated initially in development of an observation network for that particular region. The Willamette also has gaps. And we anticipate that we'll approach the problem in exactly the same way, looking at what's available, looking at where are the gaps, and trying to fill the gaps rather than looking at the
situation. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You say you're hard science, okay, but even with hard science, what has been the peer review? Have you been peer reviewed? Has CORI been peer reviewed? If so, by whom? And if I could add one further to that, has it been peer reviewed by IMST, that's the interdisciplinary?
The independent.
Independent multidisciplinary science team that has been created by this body to work with us, provide us the scientific information on salmon recovery in Oregon.
CORI has been peer reviewed in a number of different ways. When we submit a proposal for funding, there is peer review of those, when we submit to NSF or ONR and so forth. And when that proposal is based on CORI, obviously there is a peer review of the system. There are a number of peer-reviewed publications that have been submitted or, in some cases, published that are based on CORI data. That's a peer review element there as well. We have very recently conducted work in cooperation with the University of Washington and National Marine Fisheries on physical habitat for juvenile salmon that is currently being peer-reviewed. By a group put together by DPA and the National Marine Fisheries Service. I don't know whether I answered your question, but we have a number of different mechanisms for peer review of elements of the CORI system. We have not been reviewed by IMST per se, no. But we'll welcome that.
Madam Chair. The other question that I guess I would have, or another question I would have with this is, has there been a proposal for this funding submitted to the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board? if I may follow that. Has there been any consideration of that as a source of funding for it?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, it's possible.
But follow that, and then why was the decision made not to pursue OWEB?
Well, it's not a decision that has been cast in stone.
Okay.
The quarry system is a different system than most that exists. We have been developing a number of concepts. We have been exploring the system. The system is reaching maturity. There is a diversity of funding sources that we are pursuing. This request is only one of them. Typically, the way we operate in funding situations like these is we don't approach funding alone. We create the groups of individuals, scientists of various types, that are interested in pursuing the funding. And I presume that's what is going to happen in that particular case when we approach the watershed issue.
Okay.
Representative King.
Two questions. One is, not seeing the project whole budget. I see a $2 million request, but I don't know if we're going to be generating any federal match or whether you're substantially funded, and this would represent a modest portion of the budget. I don't have any picture before me on that. And the other is that I understand the request. We're looking to expand this into the Willamette. Certainly, we can see some reasons for that. But then I'm wondering, does this grow to Upper Columbia, include the Snake? Where does the, funding picture eventually go? Who pays? I also don't have, a good understanding of the cost benefit, for this. I see it's pretty hot technology, but I also have to believe that you're doing a lot more than having a fancy way to predict how the tide moves the salinity in and out. But I don't have a good picture yet of the cost benefit of your project. And I'm certainly willing, beyond this hearing to be able to do more in-depth, understanding if someone would like to help me with that.
Chair Close, Representative King, there are several questions. I'll try not to forget what those are and address them. The first one, how does $2 million fit the context of funding for CORI? CORI is run with a budget of about three-quarters of $1 million per year on a routine basis. Most of that is federal funding from multiple sources, although there is some more regional funding as well. We have been running CORI since 1996, and every year the budget is a little different, but $2 million represents a significant but not majority of funding for what has been developed. In terms of cost-benefit analysis, one of the things that we find, and I'll try to illustrate, is that by developing an infrastructure of this type, you really make specific studies much less expensive than they would be otherwise. It's somewhat difficult to quantify, but I'll give you what might be an extreme example. The city of Astoria is under regulatory mandate to deal with the effluent discharge in ways that take into account the environmental conditions near the outfall. They have asked for our help in doing so, and except for the specific instruments which installation is required for that, by the presence of CORI, we are able to address the request at a very nominal cost, meaning a couple thousand dollars a year in terms of maintenance. This would not be possible without the presence of these systems. Now, it's clearly an extreme example, but in every proposal that I have written to address a regional issue, it's issues related to physical habitat and so forth. The presence of quarry has enabled us to have enormous economies of scale. All the work that we have done for the National Marine Fisheries for estuarine habitat, for instance, was at a cost of a few tens of thousand dollars, and what would normally be a couple of hundred thousand dollars effort. Because we had the backbone already in place, that we didn't need to reinvent again I hope I addressed your question.
And then there was also the growth of territory.
I'm sorry. The Snake River is a different question. I certainly envision that the right way or a powerful way to approach problems in the region is to have an equivalent of quarry above Bonneville Dam, aiming to the Snake River. Whether that should be something that we do is more questionable, because there are a number of agencies and players that are specializing above Bonneville Dam. We certainly can help with the infrastructure. We can help them connect to our infrastructure or create a regional infrastructure if it's appropriate. But our immediate plans are certainly not to go above Bonneville Dam. We'd love to partner with people whose focus will be above Bonneville Dam. And certainly this infrastructure seems to contribute in terms of information management and support to any effort.
Thank you.
Representative Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple. If you're proposing moving into the Willamette River, obviously the super fund site designation plays into this. What is going to be Port of Portland's contribution to this project? Seeing how that would be the major player with the most to gain.
Chair Close, Representative Cruz, I certainly cannot speak for the Port of Portland. The Port of Portland is one of several potential users of the system in the Willamette River to which we have been hoping. It's not the only potential user by means. We have certainly been talking with the friends of DEQ, other PRPs, potentially responsible parties, and federal agencies, means the MPA, as an example. That's a question that I'm afraid I'm very glad to refer to them.
Okay. I'm going to follow up another question. In the Astoria case that you were developing the information for NIMS, did they reimburse you for the information? Or did you just give it to them?
We are talking about the research project with National Marine Fisheries Service.
Mm-hmm.
That was a research project, and as such, it was a research project that was funded by the National Marine Fisheries Service.
Okay. I guess, Madam Chair, not necessarily a question, more of a concern as far as what we do in stream in the state of Oregon. The driving concerns for me are ESA and clean water, and I need to know that there's a really solid connection here. For that, my question about moving into the Willamette, and I think it may be, I'm not saying anything negative about the technology. It may be incredibly significant in the Willamette River, but my main concern there is what the City of Portland and what the Port of Portland are willing to contribute to this technology if they see that it's a value. I guess I just don't, our compliance with ESA and clean water have to be our driving forces here, and I want to make sure that this is speaking to that objective.
Comment?
Chair Close, ESA has certainly been a driving force for a lot of what we have been doing, including in different times and clean up that really for sure.
Right. And I appreciate that, but I haven't seen it, so. You know, Madam Chair, I guess, I mean, this is interesting information. Maybe I just need more. I don't know.
All noted. Representative Morgan.
I keep coming back to the $2 million general fund hit here. One of the issues that we run up against with the Columbia River is that we've got a lot of neighbors that are also part of the river system. And I was just curious on the work that you've done in the lower end of the Columbia. Has Washington State been a partner with you at all in that?
Hello, Representative Morgan. We really looked at these infrastructure as having, as you say, positive neighbors. The map clearly shows that. And we have worked with a number of different agencies in developing quarry and research surrounding quarry. We are working with the state of Washington, not specifically with the use of this technology, but in the development of something that is related, which is the development of hazard maps for tsunamis. We have, over the last decade, been the scientific element of an initiative that started in Oregon and is now Oregon, Washington, and five and three other states that deals with zoning the coastal zone, taking into account risks of tsunami inundation. And the mechanism that is used there is very similar to the mechanism that we used in quarries. We have received a request, an abstract request or a concrete request from a state agency, in that case, Uganda, Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, about whether we could help them characterize the risks of tsunamis in Oregon. That was the time where the Cascading Convection Zone was a new major concern in earthquakes in that region. So we worked with that agency, Uganda, to develop the science basis, very similar to what we are doing for it. And once that science base was developed, and once Uganda was comfortable that what they had was the technology that they could use, they told me their partners in the state of Washington, and they said, this is a good thing, it's a good idea. And we are now doing the same with the state of Washington. So quarry doesn't have funding from the state of Washington right now specifically. There's a number of federal dollars that have come to do research in the river that involve the University of Washington and other entities in the state of Washington. But we don't have specific funding from the state of Washington. We will, over time, develop it as we choose to come up that that catch the heat.
Further questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. Very fascinating testimony. Mr. Barrett, is that?
Barrett,
did you want to speak as well?
No.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anyone else that wanted to speak on this bill?
Can we close the public hearing on House Bill 2753? I believe I'm weighing the pleasure of the committee here. Sounds as though we need a little more information. We need to consider our tight funding situation. So I'm not going to go into work session at this time on this bill, but we would like to receive more information specifically on funding. I don't think anyone is doubting the technology. It's very very up and coming, and I think would be very useful and helpful. We just have a number of needs, as you know. So please keep working on your project. Okay, I'm going to open.
Good. Thank you, Madam Chair, and we'll get back to you with more information and a clear direction and recommendation on where we should go with specifics on the actual where the dollars should come from.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Representative King.
I appreciate Mr. Strobeck's comment there, and I certainly would like to, you know, get more, you know, detailed information. You know, we're glad to join the committee member that wants to do more homework on that. But it seems like, you know, there's a long-term need,
and that we need to see a long-term funding strategy match up with, you know, the long-term user group, and that I think our decisions in the near term need to see that they match up, you know, long-term, and if we keep paying for it, nobody else will want to join the party, and I think we need to see that strategy.
Yes, Johnson.
Comment too, and I'm encouraged by the technology from the discussion that we have had here today. Sharing the concern that Representative King has, and I think that Representative Cruz has regarding the part of the Port of Portland, and I know you didn't ask a question about the City of Portland, but. I would think that those are key elements that we need to, you know, look at and consider. The other thing, Madam Chair, that I would be, you know, very concerned with this when we get into the Willamette River issue, there has been in this body a lot of concern that the issues in the Willamette River are going to take over the entire, if you wish, Oregon plan because of the nature and volume, perhaps, of the number of you who claim the Willamette River as part of your, you know, legislative district. About 70% of the body, I think, you know, falls into that. And certainly it is Oregon's river, and certainly it does, you know, demand a lot of our consideration. But I have concern that we not fragment things here in this area, and I really would be interested in and some, you know, work on their part looking into the OWEB issue, whether that would be an appropriate place, how that might, you know, work out. I think we probably can talk about legitimate, maybe, and I'm, this is for Representative Morgan and others to look at, but the possibility of ballot measure 66 money that may fit into this if it's, you know, worked in the right way, and so there are a lot of issues, I guess, that I feel we need to explore before we get there.
Representative Morgan. I
would concur with Representative Jensen and Representative Cruz's comments. I think that the main thrust of the Oregon plan and Senate Bill 1010, water quality management, the agriculture community, and also the Forest Practices Act, are to deal with issues relating to the Endangered Species Act and the Clean Water Act in Oregon. And that I think that when we look at how we can most efficiently invest the state's money, we need to look at the potential for getting out from underneath the that federal pair of hands that is on the top of Oregon's head right now. And that the possibility that this project presents from that point of view should be explored very closely. I'm sure that I'm not going to be the first legislator that talks to you about the sorry state that the general fund is in right now, and that, you know, how many ways that the fund is attempting to be stretched. And it is going to, I think, from a fiscal point of view, be very difficult to justify an investment from the general fund this time around into this. But I do think that if the connections can be made to the Clean Water Act and to the Endangered Species Act, and certainly to values that this project might have in terms of watershed and enhancement and improvement, that the ties to the Measure 66 money may be something that the OWEB board would be interested in looking at in relation to this. I think that one of the things that we've continually run into as we've explored the clean water issues and the Endangered Species Act issues is the lack of hard data and the problems with being able to grab a hold of the data in such way that you can visualize what the data is showing you. And this project appears to have applications in that area. It appears to be kind of a gathering and packaging device that makes data easier for people to perceive and integrate into things. So So I think it's an interesting possibility, and certainly one that I'd be interested in walking a little further into to try to ascertain from a real pragmatic point of view how we can use it. But again, the fiscal impact at this point in our deliberations is leaving me a little faint.
Well, I've seen this presentation before, and I'm always more and more impressed. And I think it is the kind of technology that we should embrace and support. It's the kind of technology that we should foster, because it could be the way out on some of these thorny issues having to do with power forecasting and fish runs. And so I would just like to see us, instead of saying, well, it's great, but we can't afford it, maybe this is something that will pay dividends down the road, in that looking back, it will be short-sighted to ignore something like this.
I assure you we will not ignore it. And your point is well taken. Other comments or questions? Thank you, committee. Thank you so much for your presentation. Okay, I'm going to open a hearing on House Bill 2789 and call Christina McNitt and Bill Denong.
Good morning again, Chair Close and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Christina McNitt, representing the Oregon Water Resources Congress. Thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today. With me is Bill Ganong. He is a legal counsel for the Klamath Irrigation District. And I want to extend appreciation to this chair, Representative Close, and also to Representative Jensen. We have two bills up today, one in the morning and one in the afternoon. And both you and your staff have worked hard to accommodate one trip from Klamath Falls for my member. House Bill 2789 is sponsored by Representative Jan Lee, who is not here, at the request of OWRC, amending ORS Chapter 545 relating to irrigation district assessment. As background, irrigation districts have two available methods of collecting the cost of running an irrigation system: the traditional assessment and collection method, where assessments are collected through the county, and the alternative collection method, where charges are levied and collected directly from the district patron. This alternative collection method was extensively modified in 1991 following the passage of Ballot Measure 5, the property tax limitation, in order to allow districts to make so-called charges rather than levy assessments, and thereby disconnect the collection of these charges from the county's property tax collection procedures. The alternative collection method is important as it provides the ability for an irrigation district to avoid inclusion of property tax limitations of Measure 5 and the resulting compression that occurs when the total assessments of all taxing districts exceed the maximum assessment for $1,000 property value. In 1991, the Oregon Department of Revenue, the state legislature, and the many different taxing districts were faced with having to quickly make broad changes to complex statutes governing all manners in which revenue is raised. House Bill 2789 addresses some important details for irrigation districts in particular that are found today within the traditional assessment and collection method that's still on the books, but were inadvertently left behind during the transition to the alternative collection method. So that's the background. I'll walk you through the bill. In Section 1, you'll see language in lines 9 through 12 deleted, and that's sort of reconstituted and shows up again in Section 2 of the bill for the purposes of flow and clarity. Section 2 relates to the computation of amounts to be raised, and it's to delineate what considerations are allowed in the computation of district charges, including the care, operation, and maintenance of district facilities, reserve funds for major maintenance and improvement and replacement of capital facilities, and the acquisition of land or water rights. An irrigation district board, by resolution, establishes these different charges. The resolution also fixes the time when the charge is due and payable and when that charge becomes delinquent. House Bill 2789 allows the resolution to continue in effect until changed by another resolution by the Board of Directors of the particular irrigation district. Section 2, subsections 3 and 4 clearly state that irrigation districts may charge different rates. The general assessment method is to charge each irrigable acre the same amount, but in some cases, not all land in each district is equal. Examples include the different costs of water delivery to subdivision-type parcels versus large commercial agricultural parcels, piping sections of a district, and those districts that provide both drainage and irrigation services. Section 3 of the bill relates to collection procedures and adds specific language that the alternative collection method statutes allow a district to withhold delivery of water until the charges for the current and any prior years are paid in full. This concept is already established procedure under the traditional assessment and collection method. Section 4 of the bill relates to foreclosure and procedures with respect to that and reconciles language related to the charges fixed by the board through resolution and relocates language related to the purpose of assessments back to Section 2, Sub 1, which I talked about. Section 5 of the bill establishes the effective dates of this act to apply to tax years beginning on or after the effective date of this act. And the Dash 1 amendments, which, again, we don't have from legislative counsel, but it's simple, and I'll explain it, and perhaps we would consider a conceptual amendment. On page 2, section 2, sub 3, line 8, changes the word shall to may. That's the extent of the Dash 1 amendment. As some irrigation districts do assess by fractional acres, and the intent was not to make a substantive change in this bill at all. To conclude, irrigation districts only have those powers specifically provided to them by law. The changes to the alternative collection method in 1991 did not include the discretion in setting charges that is currently included in the traditional assessment and collection statutes. However, many districts that have switched and are using the alternative collection method still use these charges, which, as currently written, may not actually be allowed by statute. Thank you for the opportunity to present this issue today, and I hope that you have the chance to direct your questions to Mr. Ganon.
Mr. Ganon, would you just clarify this on page 2, line 8, the amendment that you're putting in, land owned by a person constituting a fractional portion of an acre, shall or may, be rounded the next higher whole acre. Why would a person not want to do that? You're changing it to may. Is that what's being proposed?
Chair Klo, that is correct. We're proposing changing that to may. That wording came word for word from the other collection method, and we did not intend that to happen. In addition to not rounding up, but actually assessing on actual acres, often to the tenth of an acre. Some districts are moving away from charging on a per acre basis at all and are moving to a per acre foot or some other method, and that's one of the reasons for these changes.
Okay. Questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. Well, Aubrey Russell, Oregon Trust.
Hello, Madam Chair, members. I'm Aubrey Russell. I'm the water policy advocate at Oregon Trout. I want to address something I'm not sure was addressed by the previous testimony. I want to direct your attention to one line on page 1, line 27, section 2, C, the acquisition of land or water rights. I'm by no means an expert on assessments in districts, but this does raise issues which do affect some concerns at Oregon Trout. Oregon Trout feels that this bill would provide irrigation districts the opportunity to direct water, a public resource, in a way that could disadvantage other more junior water users. We're concerned that the ability of the districts to levy assessments for the purpose of purchasing land and water rights could transform the relationship between districts and smaller users in a way that could disadvantage those smaller users. Irrigation districts have traditionally existed for the purpose of delivering water. They have not traditionally owned productive irrigated land and controlled water rights, which they can move onto and off of that land in a manner which could enrich the irrigation districts. You're considering other bills in this committee, which have been put forth by the same sponsors. My concern, our concern, is that in combination with these other bills, this bill could give districts the ability to move water rights from other uses onto district lands where those water rights could be parked and controlled by the district until they could find willing buyers for that water. In controlling water in this way, it's our concern that we are, by putting this into law, raising some questions, potentially undermining a basic concept of the prior appropriation doctrine, which is that water moves from senior users to junior users in accordance with existing priority. When a large entity, as I think would occur potentially under this bill, when a large entity with the power to make large assessments enters into what appears to be an emerging water for market, a market for water, it's not clear to me that the smaller unorganized water users can expect to protect their priority, to advance in their priority in the way that is envisioned under existing law. So this bill, this line in particular, allows districts to assemble funds so they can buy water rights, and they can control also the land. Because of buying land, they can control the land, which allows them to maintain those water rights for an indefinite period of time. One other concern arising from this concept is that we're an irrigation district, which is set up, again, to deliver water to patrons and is resembles a public utility. When it itself owns land and water, applies the water to the land, it mixes its role as that sort of public utility with a role as a market actor in a way which I think could raise issues of conflict and interfere with some of the interests of even patrons within their own districts. The public entity that is expected to serve its patrons' needs and preferences enters into another role in which its motivation for enrichment may lead to conflict. Thanks for consideration, and welcome any questions.
Mr. Russell, I have one. Section 2 talks about the district making a computation of money necessary for the ensuing year.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess I'm having trouble seeing how just making this computation does what you're saying it will do with the acquisition of water rights. Aren't they just deciding the amount of money that would need to be available for that purpose?
Right, for that purpose. Not only maintenance and operation for their facilities to divert water and take it through ditches and pipes to users, but for now another purpose, which is to control land and water.
But aren't they already doing that? Don't they already determine those costs?
The question is, my concern is my, what I'm asking is that you consider these issues and get a full understanding of what opportunity this actually affords the districts. Again, I'm not an expert on this. It raises concerns. My understanding is that a district potentially under this language could own land and irrigate it, apply water to a beneficial use, which is my understanding is they are not now engaged in farming irrigation districts. They're not engaged in production of that beneficial use. They own land. They condemn land. They condemn land for the purpose of building facilities, ditches, diversions, whatever.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Did I hear you supporting, did I hear Oregon Trout supporting the doctrine of prior appropriation?
The doctrine is flawed and obsolete and outmoded, and unfortunately it's the system we have, and many people are dependent on it for fulfilling their expectations that their place in the priority system of priorities will be ensured. I don't want to defend the prior appropriation doctrine, but I want you to consider when you are amending it in a rather significant way, the impact that it has systemically on the whole doctrine. Instead of approaching it piecemeal according to, you know, the particular interests of particular user groups, think about, if you do want to take on that incredible task of reforming the doctrine, think about doing it holistically in a way that considers all interest groups.
May I follow? I'm correct in my assumption that you're saying this is an amendment of the doctrine of prior appropriation?
It's a change of the law in a way that redirects I want to, you know, balance of sort of power, if you like. Water is an incredibly valuable resource, and when you give a certain user group the ability to exercise greater control over it, it's a significant change to the doctrine. Yeah.
Thank
you.
Madam Chair, I have a couple of questions.
Thank you very much for your tip.
Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity to respond to the question. Shall I take your questions first, Representative Cruz?
Yeah, well, I'm just curious because obviously water district can acquire, or an irrigation district can acquire land for the purpose of the district. I'm wondering why we have this additional acquisition inclusion in law and what the intent of it is and what it will be used for.
Chair Close, Representative Cruz, Bill Ganong, attorney for the Klamath Irrigation District. I also serve as general counsel to the Oregon Water Resources Congress and represent other districts throughout the state. The existing law in ORS 545.239 provides that an irrigation district, through its board, has the right to acquire by lease, purchase, condemnation, or other legal means, all lands, water rights of way, easements, or other property, including canals, works, and the whole of irrigation systems or projects, so forth. The existing law for collecting assessments through the assessor's office provides that on or before, and this is ORS 545.381. It says, on or before the first Tuesday in April of each year, the Board of Directors shall make a computation of the whole amount of money necessary to be raised by the district for the ensuing year for any purpose whatsoever in carrying out the irrigation district law. The genesis of the changes before you today are that the Legislative Committee of the Oregon Water Resources Congress sat down and said, what is it irrigation districts are doing? What do they have authority to do? Let's make sure that the statute most of us are using to make our charges and collect our charges says what we're doing. You can make the argument, in fact, a good argument, that the changes we're proposing actually limit our authority because they are so specific. We're going away from any cost or charge whatsoever to specific items. It's a tool. The acquisition of water is a tool that some of us may be using in the future, are using now. In the Klamath Basin, for example, we're looking at acquiring water rights upstream of our reservoir for several reasons. One is to provide water in-stream to meet the requirements of the Klamath tribes and their tribal trust right. The second reason is to provide a better, larger flow into the lake, creating better water coming into the lake. And then third, to provide for water to be diverted from the lake for our needs. In years like this year, when it's likely we may not divert any water because of the requirements of endangered species levels in the lake and requirements of endangered species downstream. So this change we're proposing does not expand the existing rights we already have. It just specifically delineates that is one of the purposes that we raise money.
The section of ORS you referred to is not in this bill, so you're not changing that. So my question is, you know, you already have the ability and authority. Why does it need to be here?
Chair Close, Representative Cruz, 2 years ago I filed a foreclosure action for the Enterprise Irrigation District, and in that action, Enterprise uses this alternate method of collecting assessments. And if you look at the first line of Section 1, at the existing language, Judge Carla Knips in Klamath County read that line to say that an irrigation district can only use this alternative method of collecting assessments if it has a contract with the United States or the State of Oregon. Now, I don't think that's what it says, but that's how Judge Knips interpreted it. It took 1,100 pages of legislative history and several thousand dollars in attorney's fees to demonstrate to her that in 1991, when this statute was last amended, the intent of the legislature is expressed in the testimony and by the members of the committee that heard the testimony, was that every district in the state can use this. You do not have to have a contract with the United States or the State of Oregon. Again, part of the genesis of these changes is just to say, to avoid that problem in the future, avoid in some kind of litigation issue, or we're going to be looking at pipelines later in the day. One of the issues we've run across is when you go to the Bureau of Reclamation for grants, conservation grants to pipe canals, they ask you, do you have authority to do this? And with the court system of strictly construing law, narrowly construing your authority, that's another issue where we're trying to say, yeah, we've been doing it all along. We believe we have authority, but now let's be specific. Here it is in the statute. You can hold it up to them and show it to them. So that's all we're trying to do with this law as well, is to say, yes, we've had this authority since 1909 to collect money to purchase water rights or canal easements and those kinds of things, but we want it to be very specific in the law so we don't run into these types of challenges.
Separate question, Representative King has a follow-up on this, so...
No, I'll wait until you're done. I have two different questions. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. My other question would be Section 2, Sub 4, Page 2, Lines 10 through 12. It sounds to me that this gives you gives the Board of Directors the ability to charge a fee to somebody who's not even part of your district. Is that true?
No. No, what it says is that in some places, irrigation districts or drainage districts provide two services. One is the delivery of irrigation water. The second is to take away drainage.
Right.
The current statute, through the assessor's office, says you will assess each acre the same. And by practice, where land is only getting one service, it's not appropriate or fair to charge them a full fee, the full cost of providing irrigation and drainage when they're not using irrigation or they're not using drainage. So this is just so that you can have a charge by the service you're providing rather than...
But these are members of the district.
That is correct.
Okay.
Yeah, we can only charge members of the district. Okay. And all members have the ability to exclude from the district.
Okay, I just wanted the clarification. Thank you.
Further questions? Representative King.
A question about the climate adjudication. You talked about, the environmental aspects of being able to do this, in the climate system. But, I wanted to ask Mr. Russell, because I think I heard you say that you already have the right, that the irrigation districts already have the right to buy water rights. And I think that Mr. Russell's testimony was giving us the impression that this was adding the right to be able to buy water rights. And so I wanted to, if I'm correct in my understanding of your statement, and you'll clarify me on that, I also wanted to hear their statement to see if they concur, if they had a different opinion on that. But with that question, I wanted to see, get some guidance from you in terms of does irrigation districts' ability to buy water rights and then therefore impact the order of transition from senior to junior right water holders, is that going to have any impact on the Klamath adjudication, particularly with our Oregon senior water right holders, and then how we have to negotiate with California's people?
Sure.
Lord knows that's complicated enough. I didn't want to throw something in the gate.
Chair Close, Representative King, you are correct. You heard me correctly that the statute, and it's been since 1909, has provided that irrigation districts, drainage districts, and then later water control districts have the ability to acquire water rights. Their acquisition of water rights is subject to all other water code provisions, including right of prior appropriation. So if you move to purchase a third party's water right, you are purchasing that right with its priority date, with its rate of diversion, with its duty, and then you must go through the statutory process, first of all, of acquiring it, and then transferring it maybe in stream or transferring the point of diversion downstream to where you are located. Throughout that process, that's a public process, and if you're not familiar with it, I can lay it out to you, but that public process allows for public comment. It allows for every other party who may be adversely affected or has an interest in it to protest it or participate in the process. So not now or not ever has an irrigation district been able to acquire a water right, change the priority date, or change the scope of that water right to anyone's detriment. You get what you purchase, and that's one of the considerations you have when you're buying it and what you're going to pay for.
Madam Chair, can I add something for discussion? Sure. Maybe it's just me, but I think I can add some light. There are a couple different issues we're looking at. One is the ability of an irrigation district to acquire a water right,
And that is in statute, and you're right, that doesn't relate to this bill, as you mentioned, Representative Cruz. It does, but it's not specified in our bill. How you acquire it or how you pay for it is what we're interested in here today. There are two methods that an irrigation district has to be able to raise the funds or assess the charges on the district patrons to pay for those services. Under the old traditional method, we have that ability to pay for any and all things that we need that Mr. Ganong read in the statute. Under the new alternative method, that was inadvertently left out. So we're trying to specifically add that line item back in, which is more narrowly crafted than existing statute is under the traditional collection method. And I also have a note up here from Doug Myers, who has talked in his office and said he would be happy to come up here and have a discussion. I talked with Karen Russell at WaterWatch on this very issue yesterday, and I think he can add some light to the discussion as well.
Further questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
I see Doug Myers is here. Would you like to come forward and give testimony on this bill? Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Doug Myers, representing WaterWatch. I've just talked with Karen Russell, who's appeared before this committee before, of WaterWatch, who has discussed this bill with Ms. McNitt yesterday at some length, and I just want to say that we don't have the same concerns that Mr. Russell of Oregon Trout has, and we're neutral on the bill. It's an irrigation district matter. I want to put that on the record.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Myers? Thank you. Okay, seeing no further testimony, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2789. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2789.
Madam Chair.
Representative Morgan.
I would like to make a motion that we move House Bill 2789 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Morgan has moved House Bill 2789 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Okay, we did have the question of the amendment, the shall may, that they intend to make, and they told us that will be done as soon as you can get it. Okay. The clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
I do excuse.
Excuse.
Aye.
Representative
Lee.
Is excused.
Representative Morgan Anderson.
I'm going to say nay. Okay. Both
sides. Representative Morgan Anderson.
I vote aye.
I wasn't going to let them.
Could you make it?
Yeah. We get excused for Representative Hass.
Excuse me, Representative Hass. Excuse, not absent.
Thank you.
Okay, motion carried. And House Bill 2789 will move to the floor. Representative Cruz, would you like to answer this bill?
Oh, sure.
Thank you.
So enthusiastic this morning.
Okay, we're going to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 328. Thank you, gentlemen, for being so patient. I know you've been sitting in the back for a long time waiting. Call forward Chuck Mills, Trenton Karen from OSU. And the staff will read the summary.
Senate Bill 328. A allows the State Board of Higher Education to manage mineral and geothermal resource rights and proceeds associated with property of the board. It requires the board consults the Division of State Lands regarding this management, declares an emergency effective July 1, and there's also a fiscal statement attached to it.
Go ahead. Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Grattan Charons, Director of Government Relations for the Oregon University System, here to present Senate Bill 328 to you and request a favorable action on it. The bill was introduced at the request of the State Board of Higher Education, and the Oregon University System presents it to you today. You will hear witnesses from Oregon State University, and you will also hear from, I believe, the Division of State Lands. The bill has been agreed to by all parties and the agencies affected by it. We've worked closely with the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. Their interests were resolved last year and will not appear. The Division of State Lands has worked with us throughout the process. Amendments they brought to us in the Senate were concurred in by the university system, and so we bring you a consensus measure that, to my knowledge, does not have any opposition. The bill is very straightforward and would allow the, if we may, turn the microphone over to the representatives from Oregon State University.
Madam Chairman, thank you for inviting us to provide testimony on Senate Bill 328. My name is Dave Lisney, and I am the director of the Oregon State University Research Forests. I'd like to talk a little bit about what the bill would be intended to accomplish. Essentially, it would provide consistency with existing legislation in that currently the monies from gas royalties would go to the Common School Fund. However, the State Fish and Wildlife Commission, the Oregon Department of Forestry, and the Director of Veterans Affairs are exempted from that, and they would receive royalty revenues directly. The bill would provide consistency with these other natural resource agencies. The bill provides for consultation on execution of any mineral lease with Division of State Lands, and the bill pertains to only those lands that are donated. These are not lands that have come to the university system from either the state or the federal government. These are lands that have been donated by private or corporate donors.
Madam Chair.
And the bill would take...
Representative Jessen?
Does these donations, does that require the donation of the land, or can that be merely the donation of the mineral rights?
Madam Chairman, Representative Jensen, I'm unclear on that. We don't have any situations currently, nor would I anticipate any that would pertain only to the mineral lands, to the mineral rights. We have lands that have been donated, however, to the university system.
Madam Chair, if I could just follow that. It would be an interesting area. I'm somewhat interested in clarification on because I can see the possibility of the donation of mineral rights where a family may wish to keep the land in the farm, you know, for the family farm sort of thing, but be willing to donate up the mineral rights. And so I would be interested in clarification on that.
Madam Chair, Jock Mills, Director of Government Relations for Oregon State University. I believe Division of State Lands can address those questions when they come up after our testimony on the specifics of the legislation.
Thank you. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, and the we are requesting that the bill take effect July 1st. We do have some interest in natural gas exploration this summer season. We are proposing the legislation so that the value of donations by donors is fully utilized. Currently, again, people could give us land that the royalty revenues would be diverted to the Common School Fund. We think most of the donors would, in their donation, would like the value of the land to be fully realized. Potentially, not realizing the full value of a donation may discourage other donors from donating the land to the university system. And the bill provides compliance with state regulations that seek to encourage, quote, exploration and extraction of the state-owned oil and gas resources. If the monies were to come from royalties to the university, and again, we don't know whether there is gas or any other mineral on the lands that we manage, we would not propose to backfill general fund budgets because the revenues would be short-term and very unpredictable. However, there are some opportunities for the use of the funds. One would be a new institute being considered and funded through the first year by Oregon State, formation of an Oregon Natural Resources Institute. And we also have considerable backlog in maintenance of existing facilities. Thank you.
Questions?
Madam Chair, for the record, Grattan Sharons again, DSL will come up, but my reading of the bill, Representative Jensen would say that in sub 5, it says on line 26 of page 2, the boldface section, manage mineral and geothermal resource rights and proceeds therefrom. That is to say, the lands acquired by the state under the current law. That is to say, acquired by the Department of Higher Education under current law. So the therefrom would be the mineral and geothermal resource rights and proceeds therefrom required are held by for the state by the board. So it's the idea being that it's, this is something which runs from the lands acquired or held by the state. See whether DSL agrees, or whether Representative Jensen has asked this question we don't have an appropriate answer for.
I'll wait for Division of State Lands to do that.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, Division of State Lands, represented by Steve. And you're not Steve.
I'm not Steve,
but Steve is coming. Welcome.
I knew she wasn't Steve.
I did too.
Morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Steve Purchase, Assistant Director for Field Operations. I'm joined today by Jeanette Holman, Assistant Director from the division as well. In the essence of time, we have given you some written testimony which says that we are supportive of the bill. We believe it will accomplish the two goals, which is allow DSL to manage the mineral resources of the state and allows OSU to receive that income from those resources that are dedicated to the college. To answer Representative Jensen's question, we can certainly manage a mineral right that is given to OSU or to another state agency separate from the surface right. It is not unusual for us to do that, and we have done that on many occasions. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Representative Jensen.
I think this is kind of a foolish question, but I want to clarify it. It is also possible to give the surface right and withhold the mineral right, or to give the mineral right and withhold the surface right. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Jensen, that is correct. It is not unusual in this state to see a split estate between a mineral estate and the surface estate.
Yeah.
Further questions? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And is anyone else wanting to testify on this bill? Okay, I'm closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 328.
I have a question. I'm just have the rules be suspended for a while. Vote on House Bill 2789.
Representative Haas has asked that the rules be suspended and that we allow him to vote since he was out of the room on House Bill 2789. Is there objection?
Madam Chair, could we extend that to Representative Kefouri also?
Madam Chair, I'd appreciate that opportunity. Okay, the motion then is to allow both Representative Kefouri and Representative Haas to vote on House Bill 2789. Is there objection? Hearing none, we
Senate, you called her name, right?
The regular roll?
Just those two.
Representative Jensen?
No. I'm not voting on it.
This is for 2789.
They're registering their vote. We had no, there was no objection.
Representative Cox?
No.
Representative Corey?
No. I'd like to clarify that I, Madam Chair, if I might, but I'm going to vote no just because I need to do some more research before I probably don't have a problem with the bill, but I want to make sure.
So you're not about filing in kind of a minority report on this?
Yes, he's not.
Thank you very much. Okay, is there anything else to come before the committee? Seeing nothing, we are.
Cool. I like being in town.